We are starting 2024 with something that many of us may not have expected. And that is that as what we refer to often as gun culture continues to be faced with an existential question of what is it here for and what does it believe in, we are starting to see individuals occasionally pop up from time to time, frustrated in a sense that other people are becoming Christians like them, that their faith is no longer a unique factor in this environment, but rather in a sort of sad marketing sense, they have to choose to involve, or they have to choose to criticize perhaps new believers in their authenticity. This is an aggressive way to start 2024, but I have been gone for some time now, and I hope that you were able to enjoy your Christmas and New Year's. In observation of many of the people that we know, as well as phone calls with friends and communications around beyond the internet, the one thing I want you to start off this year is recognizing that you are not alone. 2023 was a hard year for many of us. Whether it was financial difficulties or household struggles or deaths in the family, it's not so much to say that whatever your struggles were in themselves, not unique, they were certainly applicable to you, but 2023 was by no means an easy year for almost anybody that I know. And you could say, well, you know, you don't know a lot of people. Fine, go with that criticism. But I think if you look outside your window and your door, and you go in outside your own home, I think we'll find that many of us had a mountain to climb for last year. And 2024 comes about with a breath of fresh air, we hope, even though it seems like the escalation has increased. And I believe that we are coming to an important time in history. When I say I believe it, I am saddled with two questions. Is the wait simply here stated for urgency? Am I just saying this to get attention? Does it really matter to me? Or is this something that I genuinely believe? Do I actually believe that we are witnessing the end of the secular era? Now, this first episode of 2024 could be titled many things, but I want to resume the year and our regularly scheduled programming with a starting point of what happened last year. Redacted as a company, as whatever this is, we met our goals last year. We met our goals as far as getting a certain number of episodes out, covering a certain number of topics, and having a certain number of guests on. In another sense, we had set a goal for reaching 100,000 views as far as just in videos, plays, social media. And we're talking about mostly of this podcast itself. And we reached that by about, I believe, August. So we were able to pass our goal. And we would like to, I don't know if I want to say announce our goals for this year, but I'm starting to formulate what I would like to accomplish this year as far as the podcast and what I'm doing through Redacted. And one of the things that continually will come up, but is it must start at the beginning of the year when we look at opportunities of reflection, is that what is the purpose of this project? What is the purpose of this company? What was the mission that I set out or we set out to accomplish? And that has not necessarily evolved, but become more clear over time. The purpose of Redacted is buried in the name. The world that we live in is an asymmetry. Our government, the world that we exist amongst with corporations and companies and governments in that sense, for some reason believe that they are permitted to keep secrets, hide things from the population, but no amount of your individual liberty will go uninfringed. We started in 2020, was it two? Yes, 2022 now. We did our first season one, Operation One, Cabin in the Woods with Archway Defense, which was supposed to point to how there really is no cabin anymore. There is no way to escape the world. You cannot go west, young man. There is nowhere left to hide. Instead, the frontier is going to be mostly on the line of religion, faith, and the mind. We live in a world, at least in America, where we are allowed to bear arms, sort of. But if we use them, even morally so, in self-defense cases, we often find ourselves on the ropes against a punishing judicial system that is slated to favor the criminal. Leaving Minnesota in 2022 was a year of leaving a city that felt like it had quit. It had quit at justice or at identity or at existence. And while I may be critical of my former home, I am not without some acknowledgement that many people that I know and care about still live there. And so Redacted as a brand, is a call to reestablish those deep philosophical beliefs that we may believe our founding fathers held, or more importantly, that we should hold, that the rights of an individual are fundamentally a religious concept, that you could even have rights. And the war, the conflict, the unstated the hidden war, in that sense, that we are dealing with when it comes to rights is not just about which ones are protected or broken or attacked, let's just say, infringed upon, but where people even believe they come from. For example, if you believe that a person's human rights comes from or are granted to them by their government, then you and I do not believe in the same thing when it comes to rights. And the point where those two conflict very possibly could end up being violent. So how do we deal with issues of infringements and in sovereignty, or how do we deal with issues like infringements in our world where we are expected, treated, or groomed in a sense to not pay attention to such things? And so the goal, the mission statement, boiled down into a few small words, is that Redacted is here to give you the intellectual tools for surviving an unfriendly environment, particularly when it comes to information, belief, and knowledge. It is a philosophical endeavor as well as a media production. We have our podcast, we have our social media, and the primary goal is so that when a man is faced with the decision to defend himself and does so properly, he will have the intellectual tools to deal with the moral challenges that are within it. One experience that I have had is that while I was in the military, which was quite some years ago now, one of the consistencies that I've seen, not only in my own experience, but in literature through time, is that those who do not have a solid worldview when it comes to morality are more prone to moral injuries. And moral injuries are half of the equation of PTSD. And so if we are able to build within ourselves, within our minds and our hearts, a strong moral framework, a way of navigating the world and observing morality, then not only will we be more capable, whether it's on the battlefield or in our home or in our workplace, but that in the event there is, let's call it a disaster or an emergency or a Strauss Howe generation theory, hard times framework, that we will be the strong men, that we will be strong men capable of providing for our families and setting for ourselves a mission in a direction, or looking to the source of goodness so that we may pursue goodness as best we are able. Now, I begin 2024 with a statement, and that is that I believe that the secular age may be coming to a close. And I am using the phrase secular age in the same way that Charles Taylor did. And I am referencing a book, How Not to Be Secular, Reading Charles Taylor, written by James K.A. Smith. And so in order for me to say that the secular age is coming to a close, I want to spend a little bit of time describing what that is and what I think it's going to look like going forward. 2024 has already set itself on a fever pitch when it comes to politics, religion, faith, conflicts on the border, and around the globe, and it has set itself off and even set itself aside from the years prior with the amount of palpable and acted on tension across the globe, but more particularly in the West. And so in this book, How Not to Be Secular, by James K.A. Smith, he talks about definitions for secular. And I'm going to read some quotes here. There are, and just to be clear, he lists three different definitions or kind of taxonomy is a word that he uses for what it means, what I'm talking about or what he's talking about or what even Charles Taylor is talking about when it comes to the secular. So as for the first, in classical or immediate medieval accounts, the secular amounted to something like the temporal, the realm of earthly politics or the mundane vocations. This is the secular of the purported secular sacred divide. In this definition of secular, in this use of the word secular, if you're going to look at Western political philosophy, more specifically the history of Western political philosophy, there's a reason why he's referring to medieval accounts. And that is the pre-modern or medieval era viewed what we call secular as one part of a person's life. There is the sacred, and then there is the secular, and the secular has to do, or the sacred had to do with the spirit, oftentimes the mind, but also one's participation in the mystical world as it is seen. But the secular side of it was one's job, one's farming and agrarian life, the tasks that they went about in their daily life. That there were sacred actions like prayer and fasting and holidays, maybe not holidays, but traditional celebrations. And then there were secular experiences like work and labor and even taxes. You could see something like give to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's being a heavy influence on this era. But and there are still places in the world where this sort of worldview of the sacred and the secular, that separation is still visible. One most notably would be many Arabic Muslim communities, many or some of them that I've lived in or spent time around, like Morocco or Afghanistan or Iraq. In Iraq and Morocco, one consistency that you'll find is that whatever is inside the home is referred to as sacred. And what is outside the home is profane. Profane being similar in this use to the word secular. And so what you'll see, let's just say if you go to Marrakesh, is that especially in the older part of town, the homes might look dirty or uninspiring from the outside. They're just walls with maybe some windows, but high walls around a compound or around a home. But if you go inside the home or into a medina, you will find that the inside is very lavishly decorated, very clean, very well taken care of. It has a sense of beauty to it, whereas the outside is very, where the outside is very stark and simple and almost utilitarian. And so that way, that definition of the secular, the medieval definition of the secular, refers to one part of a person's role in life, and it can sometimes be referenced in forms of Platonism, or Plato, where the physical world, and this is where you get into forms of like even Christian Gnosticism, where the mind and the spirit are somehow trapped in a physical body, and they've been trapped there by the demiurge, which is not going to be, I don't want to go into for this specific episode. But around the time of the Enlightenment, a second definition or use of the word secular started to arise. and this is referred to as the Enlightenment period is oftentimes referred to as modernity. So I'm going to read a second passage here. In modernity, particularly in the wake of the Enlightenment, secular begins to refer to a non-sectarian, neutral, and a-religious space or standpoint. The public square is secular insofar as it is allegedly non-religious. Schools are secular when they are no longer parochial, hence public schools are thought to be secular schools. Now, this is that time, this is that era we must recognize when the idea of the separation of church and state started to arise. The Enlightenment era wasn't really as enlightened if we want to look at the activities of mankind, but it did include some noteworthy changes from the medieval period. There were religious wars in both the Enlightenment era as well as in the medieval era. Just in one time we called them Crusades, in the other one we called them the Hundred Years' War, or the war between Catholics and Protestants. Religious wars existed in this era, but the definition of secular began to change, as in what was considered sacred was no longer as corporate or collected or community-focused and much more individualistic. Now, secularism, that this modernity, Enlightenment version of secular, was simply something that would be maybe rational or physical, empirical, something that could be ascertained through a scientific method. But there is a third definition that Taylor provides for what is referred to as secular, and this is what I believe is the definition of secular that many of us grew up in, which would be the postmodern era. And I quote, "But Taylor helpfully articulates a third sense of the secular, and it is this notion that should be heard in this title, A Secular Age," which is the title of Taylor's book. "A society is secular insofar as religious belief or belief in God is understood to be one option among others and thus contestable and contested. At issue here is a shift from the conditions of belief." And so this third definition of secular, remember the first is sort of a separation between our earthly challenges and our spiritual activity. The second one is secular would be anything that would be closer to empirical or not necessarily, well, it's kind of like in that a-religious sense. It's sort of indifferent to religion. Whereas the third definition of secular is the age of secularism that we grew up in, or the secular age according to Taylor. And that era, that timeline, is defined by belief. The most important factor of belief is authenticity. So in the Enlightenment era, you might say that the most important factor of belief would be, what is it, rational? We highly valued rationalism and the idea of a thing being rational and that we could systematically come to a belief. In the medieval period, there's a little bit of discussion over what the primary modus operandi for belief was. However, it might oftentimes look something like revelation. When I look into the majesty of the world, I see God's creation. And so there is something within me that yearns to have a relationship with God, and it is one's spiritual activity and journey, in a sense, to pursue it, which should be separate and understood as separate from the mundane. Now, the Reformation had an impact on this because it sought, or at least described itself in a way, to take everything that was secular and raise it to the level of the spiritual or the religious. And critics of the Reformation, particularly in the Catholic Church, argued that instead of raising everybody up to the position of priesthood, lowered the value of priesthood to that of pick a challenge, but to that of the less committed or articulate. It's not quite an elitist argument, but I need to kind of polish that up for the future conversations. But the secular age, the specific one that I'm talking about that I believe is coming to an end, is the one that many of us grew up in, where faith is something more like a personal expression. It's a fashion statement. And much like the clothes that you wear and the activities, the non-life changing activities that you participate in, or life defining activities that you, they would define it in some sense, but that you participate in, what this era of secularism focused on was personal authenticity. It didn't matter whether it was right or true or good in that sense, in some sort of objective means. It had to be subjectively good. It was my expression, my belief, what I believe is my spiritualism. And so it gave way in that third form, as Taylor describes, as one option amongst many and thus contestable, as a person could, if in its sort of in our late stages, claim to be spiritual but not religious, as if you could claim all of the values and components of a religion without the commitments to it. And why I believe that this era is coming to an end is that the secular age has no foundation. Secularism, in this sense, is mostly defined by doubt and personal authenticity, both of which do not have a foundation in reality other than what a person feels or wants to feel or believes or wants to believe. It isn't as important whether that belief is rational. It would be more important that that belief is authentic. And so what we're doing here, and what I'm saying is, what I'm saying about the end of the secular age, is that the evidence for it coming to close is that the mechanism of belief is shifting. It is no longer faith in oneself that one must attribute to, but faith in something greater to them. And we are being faced with two options. You have, on the one hand, Imago Dei, the identity of man is created in the image of God, and you have the other option, Imago Imperium, that the identity of man is created in their own image, most notably in perhaps government. And so a small prediction that we might come to believe or expect is that there will be a breakdown of the separation of church and state. Now, we have already seen this happen in the 1900s, where there was a sort of Enlightenment assumed separation of church and state, but instead of, say, the church, a religious institution in a classic sense, rising to authority like the Pope or the papacy, in many Western and westernizing-ish countries such as Russia, America, or even some Eastern countries like China, what we saw was a religion of the state. There was no separation of church and state because adherence to the state was held with religious fervor, particularly in, to some extent, the National Socialist Party of Germany, the Stalinist style of socialism and communism in Russia, and then Maoist communism in China, that it was the delivery mechanism and the fervor and the belief mechanism that was demanded by these governments was that you had faith in the state, and they could harbor no apostate. They could suffer no heretic to live, as it is said. And why I believe that this is a representation of what is to come is because, since secularism in that third sense as defined by Taylor doesn't have a foundation other than the personal experience, and we've seen that very nature break down and require institutional support, the only place that it gets to look is the government, and we have seen the government wield quote-unquote movements like it would the fabled Spanish Inquisition. Look no further than to what is defined in our sort of religious political philosophy on whatever it means to be queer. You've heard it said, you may have heard it said, that the definition of being queer is an identity without an essence, which to many of us might sound like a child using words that he doesn't really understand. However, these words have important meaning in both classical and Enlightenment era philosophy. And that's because they both have to do with the identity of man and the identity of God. See, what we're dealing with here is a masquerading of madness that turns out to be a very, very dangerous worldview. It isn't simply that we are addressing a problem of the silliness in its scientism or scientificism or whatever you want to call it, but rather that there's a much deeper worldview attached to it. The idea of the word essence refers to what a thing is or what makes it that thing. An identity is what a thing understands itself to be, or it has to do with what a thing is. So you could say that an identity is dependent on a thing's essence. Now, in religious philosophy, particularly that of the Christian path, mankind gets its identity through its essence, and its essence is the breath of God, spoken of in Genesis. We are our very identity. What makes us who we are is that we are created in the image of God, and that we are image bearers of Him through His creation. And our essence is that breath of life. It is that image. Whereas God Himself, God, whatever it is that you understand to be as God, would by definition be a self-sufficient identity. I've talked about the Euthyphro dilemma before, and the Euthyphro dilemma goes something like this: does God love that which is good, or is it good because He loves it? The Euthyphro dilemma was brought up by Socrates in the writings of Plato, and it identified that if a person views God as loving that which is good, then he is sort of beholden to whatever determines a thing to be good, and thus isn't God. In the same way, if God was dependent on something else for his existence, say creation, the universe, or the thoughts and prayers of man, then God's essence would not be self-sufficient, or God's identity would not be self-sufficient. But instead, whatever it is that has a self-sufficient identity is, by classic definition, God of the universe, of the cosmos, of everything that exists. It is the greatest being, and it is the only thing that does not require something else to exist. And so when a person says that they are an identity without an essence, they are quite literally telling you that they are God, and you must worship them. And you worship them by affirming their godhood. And so this type of belief, even if it changes forms and definitions, is the kind of belief that is not only anti-secular, but is a significant harbinger in the end of the secular era. So, buckle up as we go into 2024. It's already been a spicy year, and we are going to expect it to get more intense. If you want to support the channel, you can head over to Redacted LLC and pick up some of our stuff from our store, or go to redactedculture.locals.com to support us there. Other than that, we'll talk to you soon. Now go forth and conquer.